You're listening to Save My City, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Tony Mangini.
Hi, this is Tony Mangini, and I want to thank you for joining us for the Save My City podcast. I'm joined today by Steve Duchesne, and Steve Duchesne is a longtime city manager who is now really putting all of his efforts behind an organization he founded, and it's called the
Taxpayers for the Michigan Constitutional Government, Tony.
That's a very fancy title. So why don't you tell folks what that's all about?
Well, basically, a colleague of mine originally from Wayne Law School, a gentleman while he was a professor of mine, John Moak, and I were having many discussions about the unfair funding, as you and the league have been on a constant campaign across the state to raise awareness. And we were talking about what other steps we can do, and he basically challenged me to do something a little more formal. From there, we picked up a lot of support and steam within the legal community, and we went ahead to form this 501c3 Michigan Constitutional Government to ensure that, as we believe, the state of Michigan is not properly administering the Headley Amendment, and in a sense, they violated our state constitution purposefully.
So let's stop for real, let's back
sure.
up, because what's the Headley Amendment? Tell folks who might not know what that is.
In 1978, Richard Headley was the name affixed to a constitutional amendment that did a few things. One of the things that put caps on state spending, it put caps on local property taxes and the method of collecting them. And it also, though, assured that 48.9% of all state spending would be spent on local governments. In Michigan, local governments are defined as cities, townships, villages, as well as public education districts. That amendment remained unaffected for some time until...
So that 48% that you talked about, that was all dollars going to the state. They basically looked at that ratio that was going to local government. They said that's going to have to stay as sort of the minimum amount that needs to go to local government. Is that, am I understanding you correctly with that?
Right. I think that a lot of the misunderstandings of the Headley Amendment has not always been thought of positively by local officials, primarily because of its very controlling factors about property tax and values and increases, which is a long formula we all know so well. But one of the other aspects of it was it also mandated the state not impose other costs on locals. And as one more, if you would, break, it said, and all of state revenues collected must be shared locally and distributed on direct services locally in the state of Michigan. And that percentage was set, and it's been amended by only one court case in 1989 since then.
And so this case that you guys are pursuing really is challenging that the state's not living up to the obligations under Headley. Essentially, we think they're violating the Constitution.
That's right. We believe it's a constitutional violation. And recently, with good success, the Court of Appeals has determined in our favor that there's significant issues of law that needs to be decided in a hearing or trial.
So let's break this down a little bit, because you talked about a lot of different aspects. Yeah. It's a pretty complicated issue. So you talked about this idea of an unfunded mandate. What does that even mean?
I think the best way we can translate it in plain English is the state of Michigan says, for example, all cities must, you know, buy blue cars. Well, the cost of blue cars is X, greater than white cars. If the state mandates it, they're supposed to transfer that kind of funding increase to the locals to meet the mandate. That was the intention of Headley, so that you couldn't just have a tax shift. And that's really important on another point we'll come to, but it also prohibits tax shifts. In other words, the state saying, well, you've curtailed our revenues, so, and you made us share more with people who are service deliverers, so now we're just going to shove costs over on the locals. So it stopped that. It prohibited that.
So to say it another way, the Headley Amendment said, hey, we realize we're limiting the revenues of local government with this amendment to make sure that they're not negatively impacted. If the state asks them to do something in the future they're not doing now, the state will pay for that.
That's essentially the argument,
okay.
Yes.
Well, that makes sense. That makes sense. And till now, the state's not really living up to that obligation.
We see no signs of it. And, of course, that's what our litigation will take forward. And it's been exacerbated and problematic because of the state's reduction in revenue sharing that you so well articulate and in Save My City are very up on and demonstrate. We say in there's two things that also happen that are important. When there was a case decided voluntarily and settled with the, by the state of Michigan with Oakland County that in 1989 was requiring their health department to perform certain duties. And Oakland County sued and settled with the state saying, yeah, in the court ratifying that they were making the county do something that was not previously required. And now they are demanding that that be funded. So that's where we got locked into the 48.97%. We see no signs that they have met that for a couple of reasons. In 1995, we had a tax shift come along. Proposal A, as it's called, backed by then Governor Engler and crew. And it was passed, and it shifted the way we fund schools.
So let me ask you a question. I want to clarify something. So the 48.9%, that was the amount that was in budget when Headley passed. And so when Proposal A passed in the 90s, you're saying additional dollars were came at a time that changed how that was viewed?
Well, Proposal A is problematic for locals in two ways. One, it's a tax shift, and Headley prohibits a tax shift. So flat out, we've seen evidence already to some degree, and I know certainly our legal team doesn't want to divulge a lot of things quite yet with discovery, but basically we've seen and we've heard testimony already that they were aware of it being a tax shift. And that tax shift, when we went from local school districts, public school district, collecting their operating millage to the state system of collecting a state education tax and then redistributing it on a per pupil basis, that was a tax shift. So that's the other violation of the Constitution.
Wow, this is interesting. So as it relates to the calculation at 48.9%, what did Proposal A do to how that was calculated?
Well, by now it collecting and paying school districts in a different manner, it has really changed the whole system of school funding. And what has then not correspondingly taken place is there hasn't been consideration given that the 48.97% is really, it's state spending, but is it being distributed to all schools equally and fairly in this manner and previously supported? One example that stands out, and I think one of the best ways to explain it, is charter schools. And this isn't a discussion whether we should have charter schools, but charter schools, in our contention, are not public school districts. At the time Headley was passed, that was the only type of local education there was. So if you're going to pay charter schools in the same manner as units of local government education districts, which are public schools, then you are, in a sense, under paying the 48.97%. Because a charter school, the state may provide funding for it, but it can't count towards their commitment to local government funding.
And you're saying right now they are. They're looking at that as if it was a local school district and saying we're fulfilling those obligations.
That's right. And a local governing body is required. And a public school district, it says, has a defined boundary. It has a governing body. It has an elected body.
All the things you expect to see, right?
And basically, that's what the charters don't have.
So talk to me, too, about the idea that, you know, more money went to schools as a result of going from 4 cents to 6 cents in sales tax. Did they recalculate that ratio when those dollars came in?
Well, that's some of the discovery phase. We want to see exactly how they did it. They suggest they did. But one of the issues in the controversy right now is in discovery is finding the evidence of the calculation. They suggest, well, it must be okay. The Auditor General has approved of it. But until you see the homework, you really don't, you can't really say that's for certain. Much like our other point, which is the state trunk line contracts, mm-hmm. which is another subject. But we also want to see evidence of how the calculation is made. And we're asking for that, and we're asking for the state to agree in discovery, either to produce the documents or to agree that our calculations and our experts are correct.
So I want to go back, though. We can talk more about that trunk line if you want to, but I'm still stuck on that school point. One of the things that I thought I'd heard in historically when people talk about this is when they added those dollars into the calculation of that 48.9%, that put them well within that threshold because they added it to the revenues but didn't recalculate the effect that had on the overall ratio. Is that accurate?
The there is a contention, and certainly we don't know the state's full argument at this point because it was not successful in the Court of Appeals. We do not know how, if you subtract charter schools and you subtract the eligible funding challenges of state trunk lines and other things, the actual local expenditure amount drops to 34%. So now we have, and it's as you said, it's a bit complex when you do the calculation, because taking what you just said and calculating if you remove the charter provision and the trunk line provision, we're well below the mandatory amounts, even if you add back in this state spending, which is a substitute for local spending, they say, and greater than, then we're still going to be below the amount. But we have to see the homework. We have to see their formula to understand fully what they, in perspective, thought they were doing. See, there's really been no reconciliation of Proposal A and Headley.
That's interesting.
When it passed in 1995, nobody really sat down and said, we now have some conflicting provisions. And as you know, we have other complications when Proposal A passed about property value, taxable value, and changes in that that have never been reconciled totally. So we sit here in a fairly complex tax environment in Michigan, and a lot of conflicting provisions with not much concurrency of solution in there.
That's just amazing how this all comes into play together. So it seems like all this adds up to the fact that the state, and it would appear on the face of it, is keeping a whole bunch of money at the state level and really not providing it to the locals as was required under Headley. If I had to boil this down to just a couple sentences.
No, I think that says it well. It's saying that they're diverting those funds used to state purposes. And we've seen state purposes and the growth in the budgets in the state, the additional hiring in the state. They've really done none of the things they tell locals to do to economize our operations. And the funds had to come from somewhere. And that plus reduction in the revenue sharing over the years, you really have a hole that's been created. And local governments have been left without, you know, the ability to raise funds to substitute for those, nor should they, perhaps. If we are correct, then obviously we can only go back 1 year for actual cash be restored to the cities and villages and school districts. However, we can go forward with the proper formula, which would result in substantial increases as far as method of spending on local governments.
So obviously that would have an incredible positive impact on local service delivery. If we had, you know, those types of dollars that we used to have to provide things, we would see some dramatic improvements in local services, road, all the things we've been talking about that we're struggling to do, infrastructure investments. This would provide that opportunity to do that.
I think your statement is perfect, and I would only add that we also are hearing things about the local retirement systems need to be changed. Well, if the state was providing the adequate level of funding, we would have fully funded retirement systems. So therefore, they're part of the problem and they could be part of the solution with the results of this litigation.
So you know, we talked about the organization. Who's involved with this? This isn't just you.
No.
So maybe describe the organization a little bit. If folks wanted to be more engaged with it, is there an opportunity still to do that? I mean, talk about that.
Oh,
there.
We have raised about $25,000 from municipal supporters because they see it as a contract with us to advance a policy and do that. Because at this point, certainly they run out of options, as you articulate throughout the Save My City program and things. And we are welcome new members. We stayed in the metro area because basically it was a lot of personal handshakes and understanding. So we like to expand beyond it. Professor John Moak of Wayne Law, Professor Sadler of Wayne Law, and Tracy Peters, who's our education lawyer, and John Philo of the Sugar Law Center are all part of our partners. The actual board construct is myself and Professor Moak, because it's just a simple 501c3. Mm-hmm. We only raise money to directly go into the advocacy. So that's the nature of it. But we have great municipal partners, mostly through Southeast Michigan right now. We'd like to expand throughout the state. I'd say one thing, that our mayor, president of the Mayor's Association in Auburn, Michigan, has been one of the early supporters of it. So we are spreading out a little bit, Tony.
I like it.
And we'd like to pick up other members of it.
Well, that's great. I mean, this is a very interesting case. And I think to watch how this proceeds going forward is going to be important, because this is, you know, we have as a lot, and we've talked around this a lot, but, you know, we have two constitutional limitations here in Michigan with Headley and Proposal A, and how these interact has been something that has really impacted local government, both around the ways you described in the lawsuit and in other ways as well. It's one of the critical flaws that we have right now is our tax system doesn't work effectively. It doesn't track with the economy. It doesn't do a lot of things. And when you layer on the intricacies and complexities of the cases you've described it, you really see how dysfunctional this is. So very appreciative of the work you guys are doing, and hopefully we'll get some clarity as to how this should work, and we can maybe change the future for us. Because as you and I have discussed sort of off mic here a little bit, if we walk into a recession anytime in the near future and we haven't figured out how to address and fix this tax system, we're in trouble.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And services are critical. The emergency services, and I say the services on your doorstep are the most critical. Everything else probably can wait a little while, but those are critical today.
I agree. Well, I really appreciate you joining me today.
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate it.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.